Hi, we're back at the Radio Cafe. I'm Hollis Walker, sitting in for Mary Charlotte. My guest now is Kathleen Fontaine, who will be performing her one-woman show titled Kathleen Fontaine, The Man, The Mystery, at 8 p.m. Friday and Saturday nights at the Rail Yard Performance Center.
That's right. It's great to be here.
Thanks for having me, Hollis.
Hi, Kathleen. You described this show as an in-your-face comedy about transgender identity, recovery from sex and love addiction, and the cultural gender divide. So it's 12 hours long?
Actually, no. It runs about an hour 20, and we're trying to shave it down to about an hour 10.
Yeah. Let's tell the listeners about your background. You've got a long background on stage.
I do. First of all, I was the class clown growing up. I found that humor was an instant win. The minute I was funny, everyone was disarmed. So it was a safety piece, actually. Growing up in rural Virginia in the 70s, knowing I was different, feeling like I was a boy in a girl's body, not knowing the word transgender, that word wasn't out there yet, knowing I liked girls, but not sure what else was going on. But the minute I found humor, I knew I was safe. And the thing about humor for me and being the class clown, it made me really popular, even though I was a loner. It's an interesting combination of things. But I could go in and out through any circle of people, if you will, and be the funny one kind of thing. So it became a safety thing. And then I definitely did drama all 4 years of high school, and I loved it. And then I went to college, and I went to a college that didn't have theater. I didn't pursue it. I never really heard that I was wonderful, even though I knew I loved it. But think about the normal gender roles in theater. I knew I didn't want to wear dresses, play the girl.
Right.
I didn't want to do that, you know. Mm-hmm. I actually played a male character in a high school one-act play, and the judges, it was a one-act play festival, they didn't know I was a female, and that to me was amazing.
Yeah.
But mainstream theater, there weren't a lot of roles for somebody like me.
Not unless you wanted to do opera and do pants roles.
Right. And I don't sing that well. So, so I didn't pursue theater, but I found it again. I moved to San Francisco when I was about 22. I started doing stand-up comedy, and that was wonderful, and that was very free. But it also kept people at a distance by being funny, and it was this way to check out, like, is it okay if I exist on the planet and take up space? Well, it is if I'm funny.
Right.
And I had such a whacked sense of self that after a great evening when the audience just got me and took the ride with me, even if I riffed and did a little improv, you know, from my set, and they took that ride with me, there's nothing like it. So I was higher than any drug, and I have a background of I'm a drug addict in recovery, recovering drug addict, thank you. But the nights when it didn't work, or they just didn't get me, or they just weren't cerebral enough or interesting enough or weird enough, oh my God, my sense of self was so whacked that I would be suicidal without an intention to follow through on that, right. But that level of despair. Mm-hmm. And so I knew this isn't normal, like this whacked sense of highs and lows. But comedy has always been a wonderful thing. And then I met in the San Francisco Reporter, there was a half-inch ad, if that, forming all-female sketch comedy group, Call Susan. And so I called her. I didn't audition. I just talked to her. We hit it off. We're still best friends. She's my director of this show.
Ah.
We've been creative partners for 20 years now.
Wow.
But when I auditioned or talked with her for that, I got into a group called Nude Coffee at the time, and there were three of us. And that was magic because we were like an all-female in living color, an early 90s reference for you.
Yes.
Just in your face, no holds barred, no rules, making fun of everybody in the sense of to try to bring everyone together. And not making fun of, having fun with the human condition. So that we could all maybe step back a little bit and go, yeah, we actually are all in this together, aren't we?
So when did you make the transition to doing this one-woman work? And have you left collaborative or ensemble work behind altogether?
No, I've done some improv recently here, and was in the original cast of The Show in Albuquerque. That was an all-improv troupe, quite wonderful. I will do collaborative stuff. I'm loving this one-person work. And I direct Susan's shows as well. So she directs my work. I direct her work. We know each other intimately. I came to Santa Fe from Los Angeles 8 years ago to go to the Life Healing Center.
Oh, yeah.
Intensive trauma resolution. So I was a recovering crack addict, sex and love addict, alcoholic, blah, 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 all stemming from early childhood trauma. And I did my first show Actually, I was in therapy in L.A., and I was it was the lowest point of my life, and I was like, there's a really good show in here. My therapist is like, let's pull back a little bit and realize that you're homeless, you're living in your car.
Let's experience your life before you perform it.
There's some other issues going on at hand. Have you eaten in a few days? But I knew in that moment there was a show in it. So fast forward, I went to the Life Healing Center. I did 3 months there. I was out, and I was like, there is a good show in here. And so 2 years into my journey of recovery, I did Learning to Stay, my first ever one-person show. And it was, to date, before this show, it was what I was most proud of creatively. And
listeners can see that
on
your website, KathleenFontaine.com.
That's correct.
Yeah.
It's been great. The audience itself, I've had someone as young as, well, I've had children see it, young babies, but I've had a little 7-year-old that loved that show and watched it over and over and over, and up to a 97-year-old. So it's an interesting audience. And I'm finding that true with this show as well.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone can relate. Maybe they can't relate to the transgender piece, the sex and love addiction piece, or the feeling lost in the whole genderism schisms. Like, not many, I don't know that people that aren't transgender have breakdowns trying to get dressed around what makes sense. Like, maybe body image is whacked, or there are body dysmorphia issues or other things at play, social ism schisms of we should look this way if you're this, blah, blah. But my partner, Debbie, seen me many times just standing at my closet looking completely lost, like nothing makes sense today.
Mm-hmm.
Who am I? Like, my brain doesn't match my gender. So this show is actually a complete, it's pretty much a complete 180 from Learning to Stay. Learning to Stay has comedic moments. This show, I really wanted it to be super funny and real. Both shows are based on all real stuff. Having said that, there's just more freedom in this show. And because I'm in a place where I'm not taking myself so seriously. You know, I started researching sex change operations, sex reassignment surgery, as they call it now. But when I was 18, I went to the local library in Fredericksburg, Virginia.
Wow.
And there wasn't much available, but I just found what I could. And I'm like, it doesn't feel right for me. It's like, I'm an all-or-nothing personality. And if I can't really become male, then why cut and paste?
Right.
And that's what I call it, mm-hmm. cutting and pasting. And for the people that have done that, I honor them. I think it's beautiful, and that's wonderful. The biggest part I think that is so amazing is that they know what they want to do,
mm-hmm.
that they have a finite answer. I'm still in the question mark of, you know, I'm back and forth. Like, sometimes I'm thinking, yes, I'll transition. I'd be happier as a male if I lost my breasticles. Let's start there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I did start hormone therapy for a little bit. I did not do the injections, but I was doing the cream, and I did notice some changes in my body. But the number one thing I'm a little bit concerned about, or quite a lot concerned about, is my rage. You know, I have some anger issues still, healing the stuff I'm healing, and that kicked up with the testosterone. So I
of course.
So I went off it, and I'm now exploring being off of it. But you know, there are days when I'm like, okay, my work as a spiritual being having a human experience is to be embodied here in this body that I believe I chose to incarnate into, and quote-unquote, deal with it. Not in a negative sense, but like, what is my work here through this vehicle, this vessel?
Right.
And then there are other days where I'm like, no, I have a really nice man walk. And besides, a lot of ladies say, you'd be really cute if you were a boy. I mean, I heard that all my life.
Oh, wow. And it would just cut your hair off short and everyone will think you're a boy, right?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing, that whole hair length thing. But even, you know, as early as, you know, first crushes in third grade and whatnot, when the little girls would say, oh, you'd be so cute if you were a boy. Oh, that would just devastate
me. Well, but it's interesting because what they were probably responding to was that part of you that, in our societal terms, because we don't have better words than we have, that part of you that feels like a man. They felt that.
Well, yeah, and that brings me to present day. You know, I met my partner here in Santa Fe. And she's straight. She's been married 3 times, never been with someone of the same gender. And she had a psychic, you know, years before we met, a psychic told her, love's going to show up for you, and it's going to look like nothing you imagined. And I said, ta-da, I'm here. And so she definitely reads me as male energy, and, you know, she just works with the plumbing, if you will. But we have this incredible thing, and we've been together 7 years, and we're both still in awe, actually. But if that's not love, what is, yeah. you know? So I'm constantly on a learning curve.
So I'm talking with Kathleen Fontaine, for anybody who's just joined us. She's going to be performing her one-woman show titled Kathleen Fontaine, The Man, The Mystery, at 8 p.m. Friday and Saturday nights at the Rail Yard Performance Center. So how... Tell you're identifying as transgender, but how does that play out in this show?
Well, the fun thing about this show is, like I mentioned earlier, Susan Mealy is my creative partner of 20 years and my director for this show and my last show. She knows me so intimately. Case in point, she tracked me down through my mom and found me at the Life Healing Center when I was here. Called me to tell me she'd had her fourth and final child.
Wow.
You know? And she loved me through my addiction. She's loved me through quite a lot, as I've loved her, but I think it's a little bit cattywampus or a little bit imbalanced. She plays with me in such a wonderful way. We have three running scenes in the show where she plays my therapist. And we have a basic outline of what needs to happen in those shows, but there's improv, and she is pushing my buttons in live time in front of people. And
now, she's in the show?
She's off stage as my therapist, so it's a voiceover, but it's real, and
it's great improv
in the moment. And it's such a fun place to know I trust her completely. She's going to push me a little bit to get the richness and get whatever material she wants, but I don't know where she's going with it.
Right.
And it's set up in such a way that I walk out and I act as though the entire audience is my support group. They're in the group as well. So I play with people. I don't pick on or single anybody out, but it's a very playful show, a very loving show. And the thing that's interesting is people were definitely guffawing and laughing, but people also were so moved and actually crying. And they would come up to me.
You performed this before?
I did in late January. Yes, I did it in late January. And there was a great response, and I'm doing it again just to get it happening, and this show, I believe, will tour, so I wanted...
And did you tweak it in between? Was the first performance sort of a work in progress?
Yes, it was. We tweaked it just the tiniest a bit, tiniest bit. But people, the fact that people came up to me with tears in their eyes and were thanking me, holding their heart, it was overwhelming and wonderful and a little puzzling. They didn't actually know why they were crying, and that was interesting, too. So it's touching a place in all of us, because even if we feel like we've had a pretty decent childhood, a pretty decent life, and we don't have real pain around our gender or our bodies or whatever, I think people are touched because we're all affected by the reality of it's a boy or it's a girl and all the ism schisms that are put on that. You know, think about it. I guarantee you, Hollis, you've never met anybody or heard of anybody or on Facebook seen anybody saying, here, meet my little woman. Look at my little woman. Look at my little woman. She's 3 months old. How many people say little man? It's such a common thing in our culture. People don't even question it. But no one's saying little woman, right? They're not. We would look at them oddly. But the minute we assign little man to a one-month-old, a one-week-old, and don't allow them to be a baby or a boy, experience childhood, babyhood, infanthood, boyhood, what comes with that? Boys don't cry, all this other stuff.
Right.
And we're all wounded by that. You know, that's a piece I didn't know until I was at the Life Healing Center. And my first, they do a serenity group. You're there for 2 weeks to get contained. Well, that mine lasted 6 weeks because I couldn't get grounded. I just had so much stuff coming up. And then they put me in the core group. My core group turned out to be co-ed. I was pissed. I'm like, what? Why am I working with men? Like, 'cause you have a lot to heal with both genders. But in that group, I was able to hear that the men in the group thought their life, a core belief in their life was that women have it easy. And women believe the same about men. So both genders, and I think it was a fair representation of what most people think. Men think women have it easy, and women think men have it easy, but no one's talking about that piece. And that's an interesting thing to explore and figure out what's that about and how can we heal that.
Right. Yeah. I love that. So did you find at the previous time you performed it that a lot of your audience was LGBT?
No, it was a bit of everybody.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Susan's got a ton of friends down in Albuquerque, and that's a mix of everybody. So, and a bunch of people came out here, and I've got a lot of friends here as well. So really across everything, cross-cultural, cross-gender, across... I had a few transgender people. One concern I had was, wow, is the transgender community going to not like me or be upset with me because I haven't picked one or the other?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm not currently in the process of transitioning. I don't know that I will transition. Mm-hmm. I'm still in this place. You know, and the reality is I can identify as transgender because I transcend gender.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm in this form, but I am definitely male.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm in a place right now where I don't want to, as my words, cut and paste. I've done enough damage to my body. You know, I have scars from other things. Uh-huh. I'm not committed to doing that yet. I don't know if I will be, but I don't have to be. That's the new place for me to be.
There was a great article in the Times, the New York Times magazine, a couple of weeks ago about bisexuality and the same problem of identity. And, you know, from a different perspective, that if you claim to be bisexual, then gay men say, oh, you just haven't really gotten it yet, if you're a male, you know, and things like that. And so they're almost like rules about being, you know, instead of the freedom that we now have to claim our gender identity or our sexual orientation, you would think that would bring a lot of freedom with it. But instead, in some cases, it brings more rules or more, you know, unspoken rules. Like you're saying, you know, is the transgender community going to think I'm okay?
Right.
Right?
Right.
Yeah.
No, I hear you. I have bisexual friends, and I know in the past they had issues with that. Like, I don't fit anywhere, and I should fit everywhere. I think, you know, I really feel that the true human spectrum, if we're really going to be real about love, we fall in love with a soul. We fall in love with a spirit. The quote-unquote plumbing, the body, should come secondary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't live in a culture that supports that.
Right.
I think it's changing. I mean, I think it's changing. We're nowhere, you know, we're not where India is in terms of designating transgender a third gender.
Mm-hmm.
We're not there yet. But that's human evolution, and it's happening in different ways in different places. Yeah. It's an interesting topic. I mean, one of the things that I think is okay, really great about this is that I can voice that I was afraid of not being accepted by a community.
Uh-huh.
Okay? But I've lived my whole life thinking I don't fit anywhere. And I think that's a common piece, too. Most people have that. And yet the reality is the minute we are vulnerable and real, everyone can relate if they choose to.
Yes. We fit, in fact, we fit wherever we are once we become vulnerable and real.
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe that. I do.
And it's interesting, isn't it? And it is true that everyone feels like if you sit with a group of people and talk to them about belonging and their sense of belonging, everyone, for some reason, feels that they don't really belong. It's a rare person who says, I know who I am in the world, I know who my tribe is, and, you know, except maybe people who still live in tribal cultures, maybe they feel that a little bit better than we do. But tell me about your process. How do you write your shows?
Well, I don't fancy myself a writer, so writing is actually very challenging for me. I'm not one to sit down at a computer or a typewriter and start going for it. No, I have ideas, I jot them down. And the best thing I've found to do is to do a rant, whether it's a love rant, frustration rant, anger rant, love rant, whatever, curiosity rant, and into my tape recorder and just go for it as I move around. I need to move.
Mm-hmm.
I think best when I move or dance. So I have an art space where I do that. And then from that, I take what's rich, and then I will form the actual script.
Do you ever actually write it down?
This show isn't fully scripted. It's just a basic outline.
Uh-huh. Ah.
Learning to Stay was a script.
Uh-huh.
But Susan had to pull it out of me.
Uh-huh.
I went to, flew to Baltimore. She was living in Baltimore at the time.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, where is it? I go, in my head. She's like, okay, go in the next room. You have an hour. Write the first part.
Wow.
So she gave me a deadline. Go do it and come back. And that's how I wrote the whole show. And we worked through that. And she's like, go write the second part and come back. In the third part, so it was a three-piece situation. I hope to overcome that hurdle, but I've just not been one to be okay with sitting down and writing. There's still cultural schisms about I'm not enough, or it doesn't flow for me.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? So I'm actually okay. That's another part of the freedom with this show. I said, this is how it's happening. She's like, okay.
Yeah, well, if it works for you, who cares?
Right, right.
You know, unless you're going to write it down so somebody else can perform it, and it's not that kind of work.
Right, right.
So I want to ask you about, you know, you talk about one of the topics in your show is sex and love addiction. And you're partnered, and you've been partnered for 7 years. To what degree is your do you talk about your partnership?
In the show?
Yeah.
Actually, don't talk about it in the show.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, that's pretty private.
Yeah, well, I was interviewing the author of, Tom Larson, the author of a book called The Sanctuary of Illness, last week, and he talks a great deal about his relationship with his wife, and there are some pretty explicit sex scenes in his book, and I was sort of thinking, you know, yeah, don't know about.
Yeah, I'm not there yet. I don't know that I need to be there. Uh-huh. It's pretty sacred what I have with Debbie. See, I didn't know sex and love addiction was a real thing until I got to rehab. Uh-huh. And one day in particular, my therapist said, if I didn't know you were a sex and love addict on top of everything else, because you are bouncing off the walls in the way that you are right now, I would have you take a UA, which is a urine analysis. She wanted to see if I was on speed or something.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I was just talking about my girlfriend at the time. And that was the first moment I was like, what? And I was like, oh, okay, I understand. This feels like speed. And that was a drug of choice at one time. And that's its whole own recovery road, sex and love addiction. It is a self-defined thing. People in the outside world, of course, can notice, wow, it seems like you don't leave your house and you're always on the computer doing porn stuff. So you're losing your house and you don't seem to care. You're still at the desk on the computer in the backyard.
Right. But that's pretty obvious. That's a pretty extreme idea of what sex and love addiction is. How do you define it?
Well, the thing about sex and love addiction, it's self-defined, and they ask you to give your bottom line behaviors, and those would be things you agree with yourself, and you let people know that you cannot do again. This would be your bottom.
Like if an alcoholic says, "I cannot drink again,"
right?
Then a sex and love addict would say, "These are the behaviors that I cannot do again, or I am no longer."
Longer clean.
Sober.
In this,
clean, yeah.
In
uh-huh.
this respect. Uh-huh. And for me, that would be anonymous sex, mm-hmm. Consensual rape scenes, mm-hmm. not to be alarming, but that's the truth of it. And pretty much that was it for me. But you can hear all kinds of stuff. And then for, you know, in sex and love and addiction stuff, you have that, and you have middle circle inner circle behaviors, things that are going to lead you to that.
Ah, yes, your temptations. Sort
yeah,
of. Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just learning to regulate your feelings and regulate your thoughts. So there's a great rule, and we incorporate this into the show. There's a great thing I learned in Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. It's called the 3-second rule. So if you find yourself fantasizing about somebody or thinking inappropriate thoughts that don't serve you or your recovery, you just count to three and move mm-hmm. on. So mm-hmm. sometimes you're even 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. What are you doing? I'm counting.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
I always do the 3 deep breaths for whatever the anxiety issue of the moment is. Okay, take 3 deep breaths. It'll get better. You know, they always say that our emotions change every 30 seconds or something like that.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah. So, you know, if you can just hang in there for a short period of time, your emotional life will change. So.
Well, there's you know, people say, just pause.
Yeah.
And I like saying, just pause, P-A-W-S. Go touch the dogs.
Yeah, no
just
kidding.
Get grounded with the pups.
Mm-hmm.
But truly, learning to pause has been a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said you want to take this show on the road. What's that look like?
Well, the feedback's been indicative that it could happen.
Did you
like that word choice? Wait, hold on. I'm having a mood change. My emotions are changing. It's been 30 seconds at times a lot. No, the feedback's been like, this show could tour. This uh-huh. would be great in colleges. This would be great in gay towns, like i.e. Palm Springs, Key West, Rehoboth Beach.
Provincetown.
Thank you.
San Francisco.
Yeah, all those places.
We're all gay towns now.
Welcome.
We've always been all gay towns,
gay,
but now
lesbian,
we know that.
Bisexual, yeah. Transgender, interested, queer, and questioning.
They keep adding letters.
I know,
I'm
right?
Like, I have dyslexia, and I'm challenged with numbers. Let's not keep adding.
Right. Yeah, and one day maybe we won't have to have these labels anyway.
Right.
But in the meantime, there's a great audience for the topics that you're addressing. And especially because so many people who have serious gender identity issues do have a great tendency to struggle with alcohol, drug addiction, any kind of addiction, because of the pain that they go through.
That's true.
And especially young people. It would be great for young people to see this kind of show, to see someone who, at least from the outside, appears to have transcended some of the problems or is working through them on an honest level, I guess we could say.
Well, I'm actively trying to be conscious and work on my stuff so that I don't, so it doesn't spill over. Because when we aren't working on our stuff, i.e. our issues, whatever's going on for us, if we function above it, it's gonna spill out. It's gonna be toxic. Right. I'm doing my best to not be that.
Yeah. Kathleen's performance is called Kathleen Fontaine, The Man, The Mystery. It's this Saturday night at 8 p.m. at the Rail Yard Performance Center. You can get tickets at the door, right?
Yep, tickets at the door.
Okay. And you can see her last one-woman show called Learning to Stay through a link on her website, KathleenFontaine.com. And in her show, she talks about transgender identity, sex and love addiction, and cultural gender issues. So, Kathleen, thank you so much for being with me on the show this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Hollis Walker, sitting in for Mary Charlotte.